Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
I'll briefly introduce our speaker, who of course is so well known, particularly in the last 6 months because of his role in the six-party group with reference to North Korea. Christopher Hill is Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. He's a career member of the senior foreign service in the United States. His senior diplomatic postings include Kosovo, Macedonia, Poland and the Republic of Korea. And he had other appointments as well before those. He had key involvements with Kosovo and Bosnia, but before all of that he served in as a Peace Corps volunteer in Cameroon. Now I think this is Mr. Hill's fourth visit to Australia, and he's only been in the position for about 18 months, and it's a great honour to have Mr. Hill at the Sydney Institute, and it's a great sign of his interest in Australia that he's been here four times in the short period he's been in this position. So today, the Assistant Secretary is going to speak for us on the United States and Asia. Many thanks.
Gerald, thank you very much, but it is one of the first times I've ever been podcast. So, I am amazed I'm here on time because you have a time change that happened last night. So when I arrived, we were 14 hours ahead of Washington. Today we're 15 hours ahead of Washington. And then when Washington has their time change, tomorrow will be 16 hours. One of the great things about being jet-lagged is you stay up at night at 3 in the morning, you start thinking of things to try to get you back to sleep, and so I worked out the time changes. So anyway, it is great to see you all. I'm amazed to see you all because I was just outdoors, actually crossing the street, and I thought the weather here is just phenomenal. I wish we had that kind of weather in Washington right now. I have been on the road now for 2 weeks. A trip that, I'm totally out of shirts and socks, et cetera, but I started the trip in, I went to Tokyo, I went to Seoul, I went back to Tokyo to meet with Secretary Rice, we then went back to Seoul, we went to Beijing, Secretary Rice, then went to Moscow, I went to Hong Kong, I then went to Fiji in Nandi. And then I was wondering, you know, my plan was to go from Fiji to Australia when I looked at this trip, and I thought I'd like to do something else in the Pacific Island states. And I looked at a map, and I saw Vanuatu. So I made a plan to go to Vanuatu. We have no embassy in Vanuatu, unlike Australia, that actually has a high commissioner's office there and a lot of efforts there. So for me, it was a real occasion to see another side of the problems that we face in the Asia Pacific. I spent a lot of time on this nuclear issue, indeed, and I will talk about it some more. I think one of the sort of main issues of our age. But going to Vanuatu and going out with the Peace Corps volunteers out to their villages. I went out to three villages, I guess it was the day before yesterday, and to see the problems that our Peace Corps are dealing with there, where villages have no electricity, basically no running water in most of the villages, or in two of the three I went to. In fact, one village had no water at all. You had to take a dugout canoe over the inlet to get running water. It was truly extraordinary to see the sort of range of problems we have in the Pacific. It's also, I thought, very instructive because I was in this area called Port Havana. Sounds sort of Cuban, but Port Havana is on the west side of the Etape Island. And there in the spring and early summer of 1942, some 81 American ships assembled with 17,000 Marines. And it was from that particular site that they went and began the invasion of Guadalcanal. And now to go there, you know, I found 25 Peace Corps volunteers in a training program getting ready to do what they can do in the various villages of Vanuatu. And to meet some of the older villagers and who've seen Americans come and go, to be sure, and to talk to them about seeing our soldiers there a long time ago and now to see our Peace Corps volunteers was really quite moving. And for me, a real demonstration of the need for the United States to continue our commitment to the Pacific Island states. I think Australia has taken on a lot in the Pacific Islands, and Australia together with New Zealand. And I worry sometimes that I think the United States needs to be more engaged, and more engaged because I think if we do not address some of the problems in these Pacific Island states, small as they are, these problems could become rather large. And, you know, the thing about the world's problems is they don't necessarily happen in the world's center. They often happen in small places, off on the edge. So when I see some of our countrymen, when I see the Australians there working in places like Fiji, I'm really reminded of the great importance of that work, of the need to try to make sure these countries are successful. At the Pacific Island Forum, it is quite instructive to sit there, as I did, at a table with some 12 prime ministers, which is something I never thought I would live to see the day. But then, you know, you talk to some of these prime ministers, and, you know, we have Nauru, 12,000 people, Marshall Islands, similar, a small number. I mean, these are countries, really, that are going to have trouble with governance, and especially the Solomon Islands. I had the opportunity to meet with their prime minister and hear their perspective on things, and, you know, these are going to be tough problems for us all. And I feel very much, you know, the need to that we should be there in support, because these are problems that are not going to be solved overnight. So my hat's off to what Australia is doing there. I think this relationship that the United States and Australia has forged together is certainly one of our most important relationships. Australia has a world perspective, has views on problems all over the world. My country does too, and I'm pleased to say that the views coincide in many respects, and that we're able to work together in many respects, and to have the opportunity to talk to Australian officials and to exchange notes on the problems that we're dealing with, whether it's governance or capacity building in some of these island states, or whether it's dealing with some of the really tough issues of our day, that is, being on the ground together, in fact, having come in together in Iraq and working through those problems, I think is a real test, and a test that we are passing together, a test of our enduring alliance, our enduring friendship. So I think it is a real truism to say that the U.S. relationship with Australia is one of our most important. We have none closer, I can assure you. Australia has emerged as a country taking on just problems that I think in some respects, in some places, the United States isn't even aware of some of these problems. When I was in the White House for the meeting with your PM, PM Howard, and with President Bush, and as the PM explained what Australia is dealing with, it was quite a catalog of issues. And Solomon Islands being one, East Timor being another, and once again East Timor has flared up in the last few days. So I don't think we're going to see the end of these issues, and I think it's very important that we have strong relationships, strong alliances to deal with that. I'm also very pleased that the two of us have been able to work with New Zealand. As you know, the United States and New Zealand have had a problem dating back some 20 years having to do with the view in New Zealand of not only U.S. Nuclear ships that may or may not have nuclear weapons on them, but also ships that were propelled by nuclear energy. Obviously, this is a problem, and it's a problem that went right to the question of whether we could call New Zealand an ally. And yet, I think New Zealand also looks at some of these issues in the Pacific and understands it also has a role, and we're very pleased to work with New Zealand on these issues. I was very pleased, for example, to meet with Prime Minister Clark when she was also in the Fiji Pacific Island Forum. So, you know, we do have some friends. It's important to keep these, work all together on these problems. Let me mention now, or let me turn a little to the issue that unfortunately, I say unfortunately because there's so many other issues that I would like to be devoting more of my time to, but the issue that I think is really the one that has taken up the most amount of time, and that is North Korea. We have, if you look at the landscape of Northeast Asia, you see some truly historical developments. I mean, you see China, which I never thought in my lifetime would accomplish what it is now accomplishing, and frankly what it's going to accomplish. It is truly, truly remarkable. We see a Japan that has emerged since World War II to become the world's second largest economy, a country that I think it's fair to say today has a new sense of optimism about its economy. There's a new sort of dynamism moving forward. Russia, which is a you know, remains a country with many, many problems. Nonetheless, if you could imagine Russia, if you could have 20 years ago imagined Russia today, it's a lot of good news there in terms of its economic strength and its willingness to work with some others. Russia is doing well. South Korea, truly extraordinary. I've had the opportunity to live there on a couple of occasions in my career. And to see a country that, as late as 1971, their main exports were textiles, plywood, and human hair wigs, and to see South Korea now emerging as one of the top economies in the world with the most advanced technology, so much good things in Northeast Asia. And then as you look at that map, you see this tiny little place called the DPRK, North Korea, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And you realize that this is a part of Northeast Asia which exists as a kind of museum piece in terms of its lack of economic growth, a country that continues to have problems providing food for its people, a country that, if you really look through all the social indicators that the World Bank would put together, all the social indicators of how a country should be doing, North Korea is really one that is in very, very difficult shape. I was reflecting on that as I went through Fiji and Vanuatu, and reflecting on the fact that in many respects the living standard in Vanuatu is higher than the living standard in North Korea. And yet in the midst of this terrible economic nightmare, a nightmare caused by, frankly, by a political system that in a very fundamental way doesn't work, in the midst of all this we have a country that is busy trying to build nuclear weapons, deliverable nuclear weapons. Well, this is an issue that is that began some 30 years ago when North Korea imported their first nuclear reactor from Russia. A reactor, by the way, which has no role in making electricity, never has had any role in making electricity. A reactor known as a graphite moderated reactor whose only purpose is to produce plutonium rods that can be plutonium that can be reprocessed into weapons grade materials. And so we have engaged in negotiations for many years over this. To be sure, some progress was made in the 1990s. I'm not one to say that no progress was made, because some progress was made. But clearly, it wasn't solving the problem. And in fact, during that time, we found, and we found this through debriefings in places like Pakistan, that North Korea had purchased some materials. Whether they were successful with it or not is another story, but we do know that they were purchasing centrifuges. They're producing material. They were purchasing rods that would connect the centrifuges. We know that they had manuals to try to reproduce the centrifuges, and all of this for the purpose of developing a nuclear a material for bombs from another source that is highly enriched uranium. And so it was clear that while they were upholding the freeze on their plutonium production, they were busy trying to create another source of material. And meanwhile, they were busy trying to produce missiles. And as you know, in the late 90s, they actually tested a medium-range missile. And clearly, and we know this from debriefs in Pakistan, they're interested in selling missiles and getting nuclear and bringing nuclear technology. So this is, as I say, a problem. And we felt it was clearly not just the U.S.'s problem, and by the way, not just China's problem, but it was everybody's problem. So we worked hard to put together the six-party talks, which involves all the neighbors of Northeast Asia, for the purpose that if North Korea is to walk away from a deal, they're not just walking away from a deal with the United States, they're walking away from a deal made by all their neighbors. And so we got together in Beijing one summer ago, in the summer of 2005, and we worked very hard through day and night to try to come up with arrangements. We put a lot of things on the table. We had an agreement in principle, very short really, 2.5 pages. But if you look carefully at those 2.5 pages, it has all the elements that would be needed if North Korea wants to join the international community. And so as we worked through this, the North Koreans, I could tell, were becoming more and more nervous about it. They asked for more and more breaks, not to go to the bathroom, but rather to go to the back to the telephone and get more instructions. In short, the further we went, the more difficult it got. And so finally, we felt we had made some progress, so we called a recess. And the recess was to give them time to go back to Pyongyang and figure this out. They came back to Beijing a few weeks later and said they were ready to proceed, but they wanted to make sure that in this context we'd be prepared to discuss providing them with another form of nuclear energy, a so-called light water reactor. Well, North Korea acknowledged through these negotiations that all of their nuclear programs, not just nuclear weapons programs, but all of their nuclear programs were for military purposes. So to come to us and talk about wanting a light water reactor, which they said would be for electricity, was frankly speaking a little unusual because they had never used nuclear energy before for electricity. But we agreed to put that in the agreement that they would once they are out of the nuclear bomb making business, once they put all of their nuclear programs to bed and have them dismantled and have them verifiably and irreversibly dismantled, we'd sit down with them and talk about the subject of the provision of a light water reactor. And they seemed happy with that day, and I know the rest of us were very happy. It was a lot of sleepless nights, to be sure. And so within about a day of reaching that agreement, frankly, it was within a few hours, because I was still on the aircraft going back to Washington, the North Koreans announced that they were not going to dismantle their nuclear, their graphite-moderated reactor until they had a light water reactor. Well, that wasn't going to be possible. In the meantime, and on a very separate track, the United States and others, but the United States in particular, was looking at the problem of North Korean financing of various illicit activities. Now, a lot of people would say, look, here you have, on the one hand, you're talking about nuclear weapons, and on the other hand, you're talking about illicit activities, the counterfeiting of drugs, the counterfeiting of currency. Why do you bring up those things when you have when the subject is nuclear weapons? Our argument is, and I feel very strongly, that this is all part of the same mentality that says for North Korea there's somehow different rules than for the rest of us, and that somehow because North Korea has graciously agreed to discuss nuclear weapons, they should somehow be allowed to continue to counterfeit the U.S. dollar. Now, the U.S. dollar, lots of people counterfeit the U.S. dollar, alas. By the way, these were $100 bills. Lots of people counterfeit. I mean, you can find throughout Latin America examples of counterfeited U.S. dollars, pretty good ones, in fact. But it's pretty unusual, and I would argue it's pretty unique, that a government is involved in this activity. And so, you know, you want to be patient, you want to be nice, but there's a point at which you just have to say, no, you can't do that. So we looked at a small bank in Macau, and we took an action which was to tell U.S. banks, pending the outcome of this investigation of this bank, we would suggest that you U.S. banks don't do business with this bank with a prosaic name of Banco Delta Asia. Usually people like to have publicity, good or bad, and I thought that would be the case with Banco Delta Asia. Otherwise, it's the fourth smallest bank in Macau. But in fact, it turned out, when U.S. banks were told or warned that there could be an issue there, lo and behold, the U.S. banks started pulling their money out, and Banco Delta Asia started to have a problem because other potential depositors didn't want to put their money there. And within a couple of days, Banco Delta Asia had a major problem, and the Macau authorities then froze the accounts there, including the North Korean accounts. That took place over a year ago, and to this day, the North Koreans have refused to engage in negotiations until that issue would be could be resolved. Well, that issue is under investigation. There are a lot of people working on this issue. But you have to ask yourself the question, why over, and we estimate it's $24 million worth of accounts, why over $24 million would they hold up a nuclear agreement, an agreement that if it were implemented, would amount to, in terms of dollar amounts for North Korea, some $24 million a week. So you have to ask yourself the question, why have they done this? And I think you're reluctantly but inexorably drawn to the conclusion that they don't want the deal. And so that's kind of where we are now. We have made very clear that we are prepared to implement that deal from last September. We are prepared to begin negotiations whenever the North Koreans want to begin negotiations. We're not prepared to somehow look the other way when our currency is being counterfeited. We're not prepared to pay them something to come to the talks. We're prepared to tell them there is a lot on the table there. There's a lot on the table for you, but it's up to you to figure out how to get back to the table. Now, in the meantime, of course, North Korea continued to proceed with its missile tests. And as you recall, in July, they fired off a number of missiles. They had some short-range missiles, Scuds. They had some medium-range missiles, so-called Nodong missile. And then they had a larger missile, which apparently did not succeed, a Taepodong missile. In short, they had a kind of missile for everybody. And the Taepodong, in theory, could reach the U.S. It hasn't been proven as such. Certainly the Nodongs would be capable of reaching Japan. The Scuds could reach South Korea at any time, or frankly speaking, China at any time. So it was a rather defiant act. But something very important happened when they did that, which is the Chinese decided, or really looked at the situation and decided that it was time to get tough with the North Koreans. So the Chinese repeatedly said in the days leading up to that, so North Koreans, by the way, they know that we look at what we have, national technical means, let me put it that way, where we're able to look at some of this stuff. And so they knew that we knew that they were busy setting up these missiles. And so the Chinese knew that as well. And so the Chinese said, don't do that. And the North Koreans ignored them. And so then the Chinese repeated that to them, and then finally they sent a delegation. The North Koreans ignored the delegation, and the North Koreans went ahead and fired off these missiles. And at that point, the Chinese sent a delegation up to Pyongyang at a deputy prime minister level and said, "Don't do that again." To say, "Don't do that again," and come back to the talks. And the North Korean leadership refused to meet them. Well, I must say the Chinese are very patient people. Indeed, throughout my negotiations on the six parties, it's always the same dynamic. They ask me for more patience. I ask them for a lot less patience. But at this point, something began to change for the Chinese, and they realized that they have a situation that their time-honored remedy of patience may not be sufficient. 2 months later, and we knew this was coming, we weren't sure where, we weren't sure exactly when, but we certainly had some strategic warning that they might be testing a nuclear weapon. They did just that. They informed the Chinese ahead of time, they informed them that they were going to test a weapon of 4 kiloton range. The 4 kilotons is basically what countries often do when they begin a nuclear testing program. The Chinese promptly informed the other members of the six parties. And very interestingly, when Prime Minister Abe, the brand new Japanese Prime Minister, just in office for really a matter of days, his first overseas trip was to China. I think a very significant event. And just as he was flying from Beijing to Seoul, and before he landed in Seoul, the North Koreans tested a nuclear weapon. In short, they've really made a very defiant act. Against everybody. And the question now is, what is everybody going to do about this? I think the fact that they have walked away from the agreement that was reached in the six parties has meant that other countries, and not just the U.S., are very much invested in that process. And in particular, I think China is very concerned about this. And it was for this reason that the Chinese joined with the U.S. in supporting U.N. Security Council Resolution 1695, the resolution that was passed after the missile test, and have now joined the U.S. in not only passing in the Security Council the Security Council Resolution 1718, but also in seeing that 1718 is going to be implemented. In short, the Chinese told us that we need a UN Security Council resolution that will make clear to the North Koreans the international concern, but we also need one that will have teeth. And so we have been working with the Chinese to do just that. So when Secretary Rice came to Northeast Asia just 2 weeks ago, she found a region unusually united, a region where China and Japan are working more closely together, and where when she began her stops in her visit in Tokyo, realized that in Japan we have a country that is very much committed to seeing that this Security Council resolution is properly implemented, and with their own set of bilateral sanctions. The message Secretary Rice gave in Tokyo was the same message she brought to Seoul, which is that the United States will stand by its treaty commitments to Tokyo and Seoul, and that if either of those countries is attacked, the United States will be prepared to use its full deterrent potential in dealing with such an attack. In short, we are prepared to do whatever it takes to defend those countries. And I think it was a very clear message not only to North Korea, but also I think it was a clear message to those countries that they do not need to consider to develop their own deterrence. But in addition to working through the issues with our allies in Tokyo and Seoul, she went to Beijing. And in Beijing as well, we found that we had a real meeting of the minds. We emphasized the need to work on the implementation of this resolution, but more importantly, or as importantly, I should say, we need to begin to work on overall the architecture of detecting nuclear materials that could be passed through the world's sea lanes. This is a problem that we need to deal with worldwide. It's a problem that goes beyond North Korea. And the fact is, the North Korean test, I think, has galvanized us in this process, but it may not be the only challenge to this entire international regime. So we need to strengthen the NPT, and we have found very close cooperation with the Chinese in that. In addition, and several months ago, actually, we began a broader, I won't say formal process, because we're at pains to say it was an informal process, but we began a discussion in Kuala Lumpur on the fringe of the ASEAN meeting to try to bring other countries together to begin to talk about this North Korea issue as something that really goes a little beyond the six-party talks, to bring in some other countries that have a great interest in non-proliferation in the Pacific. And that process has met several times, and we will continue that, because I think the North Korean nuclear test is ever more reason that we need to work with other countries in the Pacific. And what that process was in Kuala Lumpur, we thought it was important to get some other states that have a real stake in the Pacific living up to its name and being a peaceful ocean that joins us all. And so we put together the five, what we're informally calling the 5+5. It began, actually, the Chinese had said we could have a six-party, perhaps we could put together a six-party talk in Kuala Lumpur, but when that wasn't possible, we countered the suggestion was made, perhaps we could have a 6-1 if the one North Korea didn't want to come. And then another proposal, this was our proposal, because the Chinese didn't want to have the 6-1, we said, well, could we make it a 6-1+2? That is, to have New Zealand, which also has, I think, a very strong commitment to non-proliferation. To have New Zealand and Australia. So we began to talk about the 6-1+2. The Chinese very correctly suggested we have the head of the ASEAN countries, because sort of major players, plus Indonesia, that has traditionally played an important role in the Pacific, and I don't need to tell an Australian audience the importance of Indonesia. So we had so at that point we began talking about a 6-1+2+2, but the secretary was very interested in getting Canada involved as well. So Canada has had an election. They have a new foreign minister. I'm not adding to the rumors that were on CNN. I'm simply telling you they had a new foreign minister who is very engaged on these issues, very interested in addressing these issues. So we ended up with something called the 5+5, or the 6-1+2+3. Interestingly enough, we had that discussion in Kuala Lumpur. It was a pretty good discussion. So when we during the UN General Assembly in September, where there are lots of meetings going on, Secretary Rice asked if we could have that discussion again, and we did. Albeit we had the Chinese were not able to come, but we had plenty of discussions over the week with the Chinese, but we were again able to have that sort of multilateral discussion with the Australians at the table. And we're kind of pleased with that, and we're thinking of doing it again. And one of the reasons we want to continue this kind of multilateral dialogue is that at some point we will get beyond the problem of North Korea, and we will still have the problem of trying to knit up the Pacific, the Asia-Pacific, so that it has more multilateral fora, more multilateralism generally. It's not to say that we should have multilateral groups on top of other multilateral groups. It's not to say that we can clearly at this point say what one group would do versus what another group can do, but certainly we need to have a sort of thickening up of the architecture in the Pacific. It may well be that the 5+5 becomes a sort of embryonic effort, and that it ends up strengthening some other fora. It may be that the six-party talks themselves are able to go beyond the North Korea problem to addressing security and prosperity in Northeast Asia. It may be that we end up doing more with the ASEAN Regional Forum. In fact, we're interested in seeing whether we can take some of the sort of seminars and discussions that the ASEAN Regional Forum has and maybe do some, you know, actual exercises, for example, getting our militaries to work together on the many, many difficult humanitarian missions. I mean, we found during the tsunami that the Australian military was there, the U.S. military, the Japanese military. We thought maybe we could do some exercises in this regard. Maybe we could do that through the ASEAN Regional Forum. In short, I think now is a time where we have to, in that infamous phrase, let 100 flowers bloom and see what we can develop to build an architecture in the Pacific that will help create the sense of community in the Pacific. I'll return to the subject where I started, which is to go to Fiji and to meet with the Pacific Island Forum. And there's an example of a forum that is not quite sure of what role it's going to play. There's been certainly some excellent work done on that, the Pacific Plan being one. But it's an example of if we can stay with this kind of thing, work together on these kinds of things, come up with agenda items, look for ways that by working together we can be stronger. I think we'll be able to do more in the Pacific. Obviously, the United States, and I think Australia shares this view, that what we really want to have is a sort of trans-Pacific approach, more than pan-Asian approach. We think the Pacific and Asia are inexorably linked, and we would like to stress organizations such as APEC that can do that. And in that regard, I think it is very important and could be of really historic importance that when just a little less than a year from now, Sydney hosts the APEC meeting, and that will be an APEC meeting that will take place out in the Pacific. I hope this APEC meeting can help strengthen some of what APEC does, maybe sort of deepen some of its tasks there, but also I think to put a spotlight on some of these Pacific Island issues that I felt very much moved by in the last few days. So I think if you look around the world or look around the Pacific Asia region and you look at countries that can produce security and not just consume security, certainly the countries that come to the fore of those, certainly Australia is probably the key country. And so we are very pleased, we're very privileged, we're very proud, really, to work so closely with Australia, a country that does have have absolute sense of what it needs to do, of what its interests are, of how to pursue those interests. And we look forward to continuing to work with Australia in the Pacific and beyond. So.
Many thanks, Mr. Hill. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got till 12:30, and there are a lot of people here, so I won't ask everyone to keep their comments or their questions brief. Anne's got a microphone, and we'll go to Robin, Anne. And I should also say, for members of the media here, I mean, I know you will say that when you report this, that Mr. Hill addressed the Sydney Institute, because otherwise I'll be on the phone. So, Robin.
The NATO is meeting in a former Soviet country at the end of November. I was wondering what will be the resonances and principal strategic concerns that might have relevance to North Korea and this part of the world.
In the NATO meeting?
Yeah.
I think the NATO meeting will certainly, one of the major issues for NATO will be Afghanistan. And it's kind of interesting because it does affect some of the efforts of the Pacific countries. For example, one of the best provincial reconstruction teams, PRTs, going in Afghanistan, and one that really caught our attention, was done by none other than the New Zealanders. And so one of the issues was, how does NATO work with New Zealand? I mean, they will work this out, but My point is, Afghanistan is probably going to be front and center. This will not be, as I understand it, not be a NATO enlargement summit. I don't think they will be. My understanding is they're not looking at bringing in new members in this summit. But another issue will be they have this global partners idea. And this is an effort by NATO countries to reach sort of formal links, as more formal links as NATO countries, in reaching out to some global partners. And some of those partners are indeed in the Pacific. It's interesting, though, that I think NATO needs to do more to define precisely how that will work and how and to strengthen the NATO consensus on how that will work. It's not in anyone's interest, for example, that a global partnership program could be perceived by China as somehow being not in China's interest. So certainly we want to make sure that there is no sense in China that this is some sort of effort against China. So, you know, there's a lot of work to do. But I think it's a very good thing that NATO has kind of discovered the Pacific. I visited NATO headquarters a few months ago and found a great deal of interest in the issues. NATO does not have a direct role on North Korea, to be sure, but they were very, very interested, and some of the countries in NATO are extremely interested.
Mr. Nair, and then Peter Bobka.
Does your patient diplomacy of North Korea reflect the fundamental shift in American foreign policy from the days of Iraq, where there was any suspicion of weapons of mass destruction, where in North Korea it's actually been proven? And can we rely on this new patient negotiation in your relationship to Iran?
Yeah, well, look, I've been at this game. I mean, I've been a Foreign Service officer for almost 30 years. It's what I do. And I believe you got to go talk to people and try to work these things out. I think the six-party process is a very, very, I think it's really the right process. You know, these issues are different. You know, it is sort of apples and oranges to talk about Iraq and North Korea or even Iran and North Korea. I think, but there too, I think there's very, very strong multilateral process with our European partners. So, look, I'm just trying to solve this problem, get it out of my inbox and over to my outbox, and then move on to the next problem. So I think this is the best way to deal with it. My president feels it's the best way to deal with it. Secretary Rice, who gives me direction every day on these things, absolutely feels it's the best way to deal with it, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
Bobcat?
Australia's got an inquiry at the present time on the future of nuclear power. We've got about 60% of the world's uranium holdings.
Yeah.
Your administration's committed to a nuclear renaissance. What role do you see for Australia and Canada leasing enriched uranium on a lease and return basis?
Yeah.
What role do you see for this sort of architecture ensuring the greatest safeguards for a nuclear renaissance, a peaceful nuclear industry?
I think... we have a number of people working on that issue. Obviously, the issue of enriched uranium raises concerns everywhere. On the other hand, there is no country more dedicated to the NPT than Australia is. There's no country more responsible than Australia is. But obviously, you know, we're looking at that. We know about this this proposal. It's a subject of kind of lively internal discussions. And I don't think I have an answer for you on that, but I think my president has made clear on many occasions that he definitely sees a role for peaceful nuclear energy. And he is actually working very hard to create a better international architecture for encouraging the use of nuclear energy. But at this point, I cannot respond specifically to the proposal that the Australian government has, but I cannot emphasize to you enough how much respect there is for Australia on the subject of its NPT obligations.
I go to Zeb and then I go to China.
Yes. Mr. Hill, you spoke quite much about your dealings with China, with Japan, with South Korea in context of the North Korean crisis. What about Russians? Could you say a bit more about your dealings with them?
Yeah. Well, fair question. the glass half full here, but we actually, you know, it has been, I'll say with respect to North Korea, our dealings with Russians has been positive. I met about two weeks ago, just before Secretary Rice came to the region. One of the reasons I went ahead to Seoul a couple of days before she arrived there was to meet my Russian counterpart, Ambassador Alexeyev. And he had just returned from Pyongyang, and from some very tough discussions that he had with Pyongyang. So tough discussions about the consequence if they test again or if they continue to stay out of the talks, the six-party talks. And by the way, I should clarify, we're not interested in having them come back and talk at us. We're interested in having them come back and implement the denuclearization deal. And obviously, the longer they stay out, the more sign they're giving that they're not interested in denuclearization, and that is a major problem for us all. I think our dealings with Russia have been very, very positive on North Korea. I don't deal with Iran, but my sense is there's a somewhat different dynamic going on in Iran vis-a-vis our Russian partners there. I don't feel that we are in some kind of breakdown with the Russians. On the contrary, we're working every day with them on the situation in Iran, on the Iranian enrichment program. So generally, we have found that Russia, on the subject of these violations of the NPT, has been a good partner for us. Russia is not interested in seeing proliferation. And while we may differ from time to time, including in Iran, on how to achieve our goal, I mean, our goal has been, we have had no problem defining that common goal. Look, the Russian relationship beyond this nuclear issue is a complex relationship. It goes into a lot of different issues, very core issues, values, and those other issues. So it has been at times a rocky road. But I think the U.S. is committed to a constructive relationship with Russia. And I must say, as someone who was sort of born out of the, you know, through the Cold War, who grew up through the Cold War, as many of you did, overall, I think we're in better shape with Russia than we ever could have imagined many years ago. So I'm not going to get discouraged about it.
One of our largest neighbours, Papua New Guinea, one of the countries that we have the most concerns about in terms of the future is Papua New Guinea. Reports about Papua New Guinea would be something that you read constantly in your present role. I was wondering if you could share what some of the concerns might be that about Papua New Guinea that we'll be seeing from Washington.
Well, Papua New Guinea is a country that is experiencing serious governance issues. It's also not a tiny little country either. I mean, it's got a population of some 6 million people. So it is on our radar screen. We have been concerned about developments there. We have an embassy actually there on site, which is more than we can say for a number of these places. In fact, our embassy in Papua New Guinea has the added task of covering the situation in the Solomon Islands. I tell you, I went there last year. I spent a few days in Port Moresby, and my own view is we've got to do more. And I think Australia has taken on a lot there, and I think it's going to be tough for Australia to be sort of out there without more support. My own view is we should be more supportive of what Australia is doing. I was very sympathetic to the Australian issue of governance in these places. I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier in an interview that, you know, we face these issues all over. You know, we have American taxpayers who are wondering, what are we doing with American taxpayers' money that goes to the government to give to other governments or assistance projects? And then you wonder what's going on there. And I can imagine that for Australia, which has really reached out to these countries, I know you have lots of issues, assistance issues, these labor mobility issues that you face with them. I would like to see if we can be more supportive to you. But beyond that, you know, as you know, some years ago, we we really ratcheted back our bilateral assistance programs, and I'd like to see us do more.
We've got two final questions here. We've got to be very quick, and then we may get one up the back. We've got to be very quick.
Mr. Bill, this question concerning U.S. foreign policy towards Indonesia served the last 10 years. You've seen a very dramatic decline, decline in soft power. Do you think that's going to continue?
A decline in soft power?
If you take 96, the high point of U.S. protection of Bosnian Muslims, and current sort of negative attitude in Indonesia towards the U.S., that's just been a very, very dramatic decline.
Yeah.
Is that going to change?
Yeah, I think we actually, first of all, we've been very encouraged by developments in Indonesia. I mean, notwithstanding what you're referring to, and I think some of the issues that have been difficult have been caused in places like Lebanon. I mean, we saw a real reaction in Indonesia to the situation in Lebanon. To some extent, the U.S. was, among some people in the Indonesian public, held to blame for the situation in Lebanon. Overall, though, we've had a pretty good relationship there. And if you look at some of these this opinion surveying, you know, this is kind of tough to do in a country like that. I don't feel that the U.S. position is a bad position in Indonesia. I mean, I think, first of all, since, you know, there's a time in which Indonesians thought that all the U.S. cared about there was anti-terrorism. Well, we do care about anti-terrorism. But I like to think that in Aceh, after the tsunami, that we were able to show Indonesians that there's another aspect of what we care about. We care about the well-being of the Indonesian people. And I think the response of the U.S., you know, we had forces there delivering humanitarian assistance within 48 hours. I'm very proud of our people who were able to do that. That's soft power, although we used some hard power assets to get it there. We have a dialogue with the Indonesians that goes very, very strongly through the economic ministries. We work with them really very closely. And the relationship of my president to President Yudhoyono is very close. Secretary Rice was there. And as you know, President Bush will come to Indonesia in about a month's time in connection with his trip to Vietnam. I've been there one, two, three, four times now. And so I think I'd like to think we've shown a greater interest in the Indonesian people and their welfare, and not just in terms of Indonesia as a place where we need to work on anti-terrorism. And if you're suggesting to me that we need to do more, I agree with you, we do need to do more.
Question there, we'll finish the list out at the end. You want a question? Got to be quick.
Just in relation to your comments about giving more support to Australia and the police in the region, can you give a bit of an example of what that might involve?
Well, for example, I think Australia has taken on a lot of the development assistance there, and we have something called the Millennium Challenge Account, Millennium Challenge Corporation, and we have begun a pretty good project in Vanuatu, which will be to pave a road, a ring road, around the main island there in Ipate. And the problem that the Millennium Challenge Corporation faces is that it has a difficult time dealing with very small countries, because then we run into the problem of how do you make sure the money is well spent, et cetera. You run into just a resource problem dealing with that. So we would like to see what we can do regionally with that Millennium Challenge Corporation that I think could be not only helpful to the other country, to those countries, but also helpful to other donors. We'd also like to see if our Peace Corps, I was a former Peace Corps volunteer in Africa, and I lived out in these villages and helped with microcredit. And to see these kids, you know, living in these conditions out in Vanuatu, it's a tremendous resource that we have people willing to do that. And I'd like to see if we can do more coordination. I think donor coordination is really key. And I think we did make a good start with this donor coordination in the Pacific Island Forum where we brought all the donors together, including and especially China, together, because we hadn't done that before. And I think that can also be helpful.
Final question, please, Tom.
Does the United States see Australia have a role in helping enforce sanctions against North Korea? And if so, how?
Well, I think, you know, we've had some preliminary discussions with a number of key countries, Australia being one, on the need to implement UN Security Council Resolution 1718. A lot of these issues turn on sort of the technical task of how does this work, what do these words actually mean. I would think that as we look to the role or the difficulties of policing this in Asia, we look for countries with capabilities, and Australia has some real capabilities in this regard. So I think we will certainly continue our dialogue to see where specifically we can work together. It's pretty early in the process. As you know, the Security Council resolution was passed rather quickly, which I thought was a very good sign, because it really showed to the North Koreans that the outrage of the world community. But on the other hand, in passing so quickly, we don't have all the mechanisms for how to implement it done yet. And so we'll obviously be very closely in touch with the Australians on this, and then we'll see how specifically we can work together.
Many thanks, Mr. Hill. Take a seat.
Okay.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.